And good evening, good evening, good evening, and welcome to Global Digest, the show that basically handles the current affairs topics that are affecting the world and have been affecting the world in the last week and going into the next week. This week, my panel is slightly different because our usual suspects, i.e. Davis and Irene, have taken a break to allow me to handle a conversation that they feel I probably had a little bit more investment in when I was pitching it to them. And today I'm joined by still a panel of three from the legal sector, if I can say that. And because I am one person who believes in everyone should have their own voice, I will allow them to make their own introduction so that we can continue the conversation from there.
Good evening, listeners. Yeah. I am Martin Mavengina. I work with the Kenya Human Rights Commission as a senior program advisor for the Transition to Justice Program. Mm-hmm. And I am happy to join this important conversation this evening. And I look forward to engaging with you all. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Shalia Mayo. I'm working
have been affecting the world in the last week and going into the next week. This week, my panel is slightly different because our usual suspects, i.e. Davis and Irene, have taken a break to allow me to handle a conversation that they feel I probably had a little bit more investment in when I was pitching it to them. And today I'm joined by still a panel of three from the legal sector, if I can say that. And because I am one person who believes in everyone should have their own voice, I will allow them to make their own introduction so that we can continue the conversation from there.
Good evening, listeners. Yeah. I am Martin Mavengina. I work with the Kenya Human Rights Commission as a senior program advisor for the Transition to Justice Program. Mm-hmm. And I am happy to join this important conversation this evening. And I look forward to engaging with you all. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Shalia Mayo. I'm working at Reprieve UK and under the Kenya Resentencing Project.
Yeah. And last but not least.
Well, my name is Winnie Siomboa, also with Reprieve UK, Kenya Resentencing Project.
Okay. Thank you very much. The conversation that we are having today revolves around the issue of death penalty. Now, if you have been living in Kenya, you'd realize one of the conversations that actually came up recently is whether we really need that type of sentence still in our books, given that we saw it a couple of weeks ago where a judge passed a death sentence to a suspect, a convict, but also had a rider that it would hold if another court does not take it out. I guess the place where we start this conversation, Shirley, Martin, and Siomboa, is this, why do you feel that you need to bring this conversation now? Is it even necessary in Kenya? We have other things to be worried about.
Well, it's not... this is the right time. Mm-hmm. And actually, I want to think that we are late in having this conversation. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the death penalty is a human rights issue. Mm-hmm. A lot of people tend to think that when you talk about the death penalty, you're talking about a fitting punishment for, you know, a crime that has been commuted that is worth of that particular punishment. But actually, it is not, because what you're proposing is to take away someone's life. Now, I don't think, you know, the intents and purposes of, you know, punishments as that power derives in the judiciary is not for you to derive, or rather to take away someone's life, mm-hmm. but for you to ensure that they're answerable for the crime that they have committed and to a worthy measure, and at the same time, also to ensure that you rehabilitate this person so that, you know, you're not removing them from society completely. Mm-hmm. They have a chance and an opportunity to repent their sin, as it were, and be able to become a productive member of society. Now, the death penalty does not do that. Mm-hmm. That is one. Now, secondly, we cannot talk about the death penalty without looking at our legal system, our criminal justice sector. It is full of, you know, challenges. It's not devoid of what we may call... basically, what I'm saying is that the legal system is plagued with a lot of challenges. And a lot of times, you find people who are innocent being sent away into prison for crimes that they actually did not commit.
Mm-hmm.
And then the whole trial process, especially in a capital offense, you must be represented by a lawyer because there are so many things that go on in a trial of that magnitude that mtu wa kawaida, like you and I, may not be able to understand. But unfortunately, when it comes to the legal representation that most capital offenders get, it's been questioned. Mm-hmm. And I will not want to delve into that. I would want Martin to look at that, to tell us, you yeah. know, the many doubts that have been cast over the legal representation that, you know, is presented to people on capital punishment. So it's on those bases that we say that the death penalty does not, you know, hold a place in today's society.
Mm-hmm. Martin, before you take us into that other bit of that conversation, she mentioned something that is usually thrown into this conversation. It is a human right. What is that human right? Because if you look at any conversation, sometimes you activists, you are told you don't look at other people's human rights when you're defending, for instance, a suspect versus a police officer. What is human rights?
Thank you for that question. Human rights are usually those rights that are enjoyed by all citizens or even persons within a country.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at many constitutions around the world, they usually have a chapter that provides for the Bill of Rights. So those are rights that, you know, every human being should enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
So the enjoyment of your rights is not restricted to actually your... there are specific rights, of course, that you can enjoy because you're a citizen of a specific country.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the Bill of Rights, you know, that is actually a replica of many international international treaties,
mm-hmm.
like the Universal Declaration for Human Rights, the African Charter on Human and People's Rights. Most of these rights are drawn from these international instruments, and you find that many countries actually try to ensure that they have this provision within the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as to why the death penalty is a human rights issue, is many constitutions do provide for the right to life. And the same constitutions also stipulate, even the Kenyan constitution does stipulate that, you know, your right to life cannot be, you know, taken away,
mm-hmm.
except in, you know, certain exceptional circumstances. But back to your previous question as to why you asked before I get back there, why this is a relevant conversation, is for a very long time, Kenya has not executed any individual for the offense of death. So the question we must be asking, or we must ask ourselves today, is why continue to pass the death penalty if you're not actually implementing it? As of today, it's actually over 30 and a half years since Kenya last executed anybody convicted of the death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, secondly, when in 2017, there was a very important piece of jurisprudence that was came out of our Supreme Court. You're all aware of the Moratetu case, that actually, the long and short of it is that it actually held that, you know, sentencing somebody to death was unconstitutional. But fast forward in 2021, the court came in and tried to clarify that is only restricted to that ruling was only restricted to those sentenced convicted of murder or attempted of murder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you look at the offense of the death penalty as provided for in our penal code, there are several offenses that actually attract the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is treason, the other one is aggravated robbery, and even robbery with violence. Now, what happened after the landmark decision and the court's direction in 2021 is that you find that those who have been sentenced to death but have not, you know, committed but have not committed the crime of murder, in other words, either they committed aggravated robbery or robbery with violence, they cannot benefit from this progressive ruling of the Mara Tetu case. And that is why the bill that is being presented by Honorable Ondai, mm-hmm. that has actually been read on the floor of Parliament, is very progressive, because it seeks to remove some of these very regressive provisions, specifically those offences that attract the penal code. The other thing I must point out as to why it is important to ensure that this is removed from our statutes books is because our prisons are congested, right? Our prison facilities are heavily congested. Actually, for the longest time, mm-hmm. and I stand to be corrected, subsequent governments have never had... we've had governments come in, you know, they build roads, they build infrastructure, they've mm-hmm. built this and that. When was the last time you heard that government is expanding prisons or even police stations, per se? Because the holding facilities for mm-hmm. People who are actually convicted of an offence are to either in a police station or the specific gazetted government prisons. Mm-hmm. So as it stands, our prisons are actually extremely congested.
But wouldn't the argument then be, instead of doing away with the death penalty, mm-hmm. why not deal with petty offenders who are not even supposed to be in jail? I'll give you the example of Judge Grace Nzioka. Yes. When she was passing the sentence to Joey the other day, she actually made a comment in regards to when she went to the Nairobi remand prison. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that those people told her was, mbono unarakisha kesi ya jamaa wawili na si yetu, it's taking forever. Mm-hmm. Isn't it just a case of deal with the petty offenders so that you can have the, in quotes, hardcore mm-hmm. prisoners mm-hmm. in the correctional facilities?
Thank you for that question. Let me answer your question in twofold. One, the reason why you cannot deal with that as petty offenders is because legal representation in Kenya is the long and short of it is, one, very few people can afford legal representation. Mm-hmm. Secondly, legal representation itself is quite costly. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, when you look at the National Legal Aid Service that was enacted, the act was enacted right from 2017 or thereabout, mm-hmm. this was supposed to make legal services affordable to an ING. But the hard question we have to ask ourselves, or the stark reality that we have to, the stark reality is, how much has government allocated to actually making legal services affordable to an ING? Mm-hmm. Many people who are remanded, many of these petty offenders actually who are remanded, actually lack legal representation. Mm-hmm. But that does not mean that they actually, the bulk of those who are actually within our detention facilities, because remember, there are several crimes that are committed, could I say, on an annual basis by different people.
Yeah.
So you find that because of the complex, the expensive nature of legal representation, that is why our prisons cannot be decongested. Secondly, when you look at the whole issue of when you turn to the issue of, you know, those who are convicted to suffer death. Yes, while we appreciate that there have been some commutations, and by commutations, I mean the president exercises his power of mercy mm-hmm. after receiving recommendations from the Power of Mercy Committee to commute those, a few people have been convicted to either death or life sentences. That does not actually help in decongesting the prison prison facilities. But looking at death penalties, as you see, for somebody to wait, if you were convicted 10 years ago, you see, you live knowing every day could be your last, and that in itself is mm-hmm. torture. Mm-hmm. It's actually torturous, it's inhuman and degrading treatment. Now, fast forward, in 2017, Kenya passed the Prevention of Torture Act, right?
Okay.
After four or so years of, you know, of progressively engaging relevant policy actors like the National Assembly. So the question we ask ourselves is, you know, how do you have a progressive piece of legislation that says, in one hand, we are preventing any form of torture, cruel and inhuman treatment at a national level, and then on the other hand, we are passing sentences that actually subject people to torture, cruel, and inhuman treatment. The long and short of it is that, you see, if somebody is convicted for the offense of that attracts the death penalty, then the solution can't be an eye for an eye. Because remember, for the last 30 and a half years, we have not executed anybody. Right. So that simply means that as it is, based on the first two pointers I gave you and the impasse as is, our prison facilities are not going to be decongested anytime soon. In fact, we have to thank the Lord Almighty that during COVID, I to be honest, I don't know how most of our comrades survived, but you can imagine the protocols that most of us had to go through. And now imagine a prison facility like Industrial that's supposed to hold 2,000 inmates, and now it has in excess of 8,000 inmates.
The one thing that you've brought across is decongesting prisons and also the torturous nature of a death penalty. But what happens to the victim and the family of the victim? Because ideally, if you're going to talk about justice being seen to be done, there is also the family of the victim and the victim, the person who was robbed violently or the person whose life was taken away and their family. The only thing that they are asking for is, can you just serve justice? What is justice to them in when we are looking at the way that you guys are advocating?
I mean, the court does not only look at the law in terms of the offender only. There are a number of things that the court has to consider before giving a ruling or giving a judgment or releasing a prisoner. And one of the things that, of course, the judge considers, and this is, if you look at the sentencing policy guidelines, they consider a number of things, and one of the things is the impact of the potential release on the victim. So, and this is where the probation department comes in, because they will go and conduct an assessment. They will speak to the family, they will speak to the neighbors, the relatives, and see what exactly is going on the ground. And this, all this information is brought to court. So the judge, before releasing this person outside, they have to consider all these factors. And most of these people are very remorseful. They've gone as far as reaching out to these victims, apologizing, reconciling. And so sometimes you find that even the victim's families are the ones who are going to court and said, I have already forgiven him, just release him or her. So again, the court looks at both sides of the coin.
At this point, I think it's where I would want to understand what the resentencing project actually entails. What are we talking about? Because I think when we started and as we are going through, you'd actually get the person who's following the conversation is asking, are they saying, release this guy or release this lady to the masses? Just because Laban said, I have forgiven. No. So how does resentencing project work?
Maybe we can go back a little step before 2017. So if you are a capital offender and you are in court, you've committed this crime, you're in court, before you're sentenced, you may have a lot of mitigating factors. You are a first offender, maybe the cause of the crime was probably gender-based violence, or any mitigating factor was not taken into consideration. So whatever it is, it was mandatory that you will get the death penalty. So this teenager went, robbed someone of a phone that's less than 5,000 shillings, did not use any weapon, but had
slapped them.
Yeah, so that's definitely robbery with violence. And I went somewhere and shot someone, and this person is dead. I get the death penalty. So this person who did not injure someone and this person who actually murdered someone, both of them get the same penalty. But why? The court's hands are tied. Why? because of the mandatory nature of the death penalty. So what Martin was talking about, the Muratetu judgment came in to give the judges the discretion. So now the judges can actually go back and listen. And before I give you that judgment, I look at what are the factors that made you commit this crime. So someone, there is a man who in a what is it called? Cerebral malaria episode killed someone. But that's, again, it's murder. But if you consider all these mitigating factors, it's probably, it cannot be murder. Not, the word is not proper. It cannot be murder.
So what would it be then? Like, how would you, how would it be described? Because to an ordinary person who we are trying to communicate to, they're looking at it as you took someone's life.
So for it to be murder, there has to be one, intent, and then now the
motive,
then the act itself. So this person did not intend to kill this person. It was
accidental, if you may.
He was not in his right senses because mentally he was ill. This was an episode during an ailment. So probably he should have gotten a lesser... Yes, there's a crime. That we do not agree. Okay. We do not disagree. There was a crime. So it might have been lesser, but not murder. That's what we're saying. So that the Muratetu ruling helped the courts, gave them the discretion. So now they can listen to all these mitigating factors and give a a ruling based on the different, the age, what were the circumstances, the aggravating factors, all this, they take all this into consideration and then give a suitable ruling. And also they consider, again, the conduct of the prisoner while in prison, has he reformed? How has he been behaving? Also, they talk to the family. Do they want him back? Or all these factors are now considered. And then this person is brought to before the court, and is the case is heard again. Not heard on the whole, but just the sentence. So this person was given the death penalty. But now, considering these mitigating factors, the death penalty is set aside and is given a different sentence, maybe a number of years, or released back to the community.
Laban, let me also just, because you asked us, what is the Kenya Resentencing Project? In 2017, Muratetu ruling was, the Supreme Court did declare the mandatory death penalty unconstitutional in a case that was brought before the Supreme Court by Francis Muratetu and others. And that's why it's called the Muratetu ruling. Now, the consequence of this is that in that particular ruling, when the judgment was being read, the Supreme Court did declare, of course, the mandatory death penalty unconstitutional, and did direct the Attorney General to look into, you know, establishing a task force that would advise Kenya on how to proceed with regard to the death penalty. Now, this task force did sit, and they have a report which is accessible on online, where if you just Google the death penalty task force report, you can be able to get it and see the numerous recommendations that that task force did make. Now, the task force was made up of different actors, including the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights, civil society organizations such as KHRC, LRF, Office of the AG, and other actors in the Ministry of Justice, and, you know, the entire criminal justice sector, including prisons and probation. What they did say in the end was that, of course, we do agree that the death penalty should be abolished, and that if indeed we must have the death penalty, then it should be reserved rather for the worst of the worst. Like this one, there's no conversation here. Like there's no other sentence that can be passed other than the death penalty. And that is what is considered the first degree of an offense, and especially murder. Now, with this consideration, again, Shirley has talked about discretion. It did give judges the discretion to hear someone... to hear them during a ruling, or rather a hearing, hear their mitigating factors, and then make a decision based on that, on the mitigating factors that that person will have presented before them. The task force also did recommend, or rather the ruling first, the ruling did recommend that anyone mm-hmm. who had been imprisoned for the life sentence, rather for the death penalty, whether it was because of your, you know, murder or robbery with violence, that you could approach the court and seek to be resentenced. As of 2017 ruling, you know, going backward, that you could approach the court and be resentenced. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened is that people came to court, a lot of people actually, they went before the court and brought their petitions. They were heard. There was a challenge. People who had been serving life imprisonment, not as a result of death penalty commuted to life, for instance, sexual offenders, there is the mandatory minimum for sexual offense, like the highest degree, is life imprisonment.
Mm-hmm.
So they also went to court and sought to be resentenced.
Okay.
Some were resentenced.
Mm-hmm.
Those who appeared before judges who were just, okay, fine, it's, you know, resentencing, they were resentenced. Others went before some judges who said, no, Muratetu ruling applies to death penalty
mm-hmm.
or life imprisonment after commutation for robbery with violence or for murder. Now, fast forward, 2017, rather 2021, we have a new Chief Justice, and, you know, a lot of actors have gone before court and said, there's a quagmire here, you know. Even judges themselves are saying there's no clarity.
Mm-hmm.
When the project started in 2020, Shirley and I went to all the courts where we'd find capital offenders records. And we went to somewhere, judges would say, I am not going to resentence anyone because, as far as I'm concerned, the death penalty is still a legal sentence.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot, you know, resentence people. So there are some that would go to judges who are like that, and they would not be resentenced. Then there are others who would go to very progressive judges who would very quickly look through their files and resentence them, either to named years. Some, you know, the judge would look at somebody who's been in prison since 1980s, is old, and, you know, feel like, based on the factors that I've received from the prison itself, they're saying that you are a reformed person, you're a trustee even. We give you responsibilities, you're a trusted person,
mm-hmm.
we think you've reformed very well and you can rejoin society. It's safe for us to say that you can rejoin society. Judges would look at this and say, fine, I'm satisfied. You've learned your lesson, go home and become a member, a productive member of society. So a question would come across like, hey, did these guys really go back and are they reformed? Yes. There are many of them that we've been able to visit. They've, you know, started to gather back their lives. Some have started businesses. Some have been, you know, embraced back by their families, and they're finding ways to do. One of them is actually a trusted security guard in one of the major airports in Kenya. I won't say which one, but they are. And you see, for you to get a job as a security guard,
mm-hmm.
not Awochi,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're a security personnel in an airport, it means that, you know, you have gotten to a point where the society trusts that, they believe they can trust you one way or another. We have got others who've started non-profit organizations that are helping young people to reform and not to go into crime. Others are providing pro bono services, legal services, because one of the things that happens when you're in prison, you can go to school and you can study. Mm. So what is the point of us introducing progressive reforms in prisons only for us to say, actually, you study your law, but forever and ever, you're in prison? Doesn't make sense, isn't
it? Okay.
And these people are good examples that we can say can be used to vouch for others.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, they're welcomed back. And like Shirley spoke about, circumstances surrounding commission of an offense. People have gone back. We've had people, even victims of offenders, who've gone to prison not knowing that that's not where to go, to tell the officer in charge, may I want you to release this person because I don't have any problem with them. I know they probably murdered my daughter, my son, my child,
mm-hmm.
but I'm okay because I know why it happened and I don't see the benefit in losing another life in prison, when he could have come back, rejoined us, and, you know, continued building the society, as it were.
Okay.
Yeah.
Capital FM.
And welcome back to Global Digest with myself, Laban Wanambisi. I'm joined today by legal experts, as we've decided we are going to call them, where we are having a conversation around what to do with the death penalty. That would be an easier way to frame it, as opposed to saying abolishing it. Before we went for the break, one of the things that we were handling was more or less the criteria of how do you actually start this conversation around resentencing a person. And one of the things that I picked out from your contribution, Winnie, was you said there was someone who actually went to a prison warden to try and get that process done. And I think one of the questions that might arise is, at what time or what point does someone actually have the right to, if I can use the word, activate the resentencing conversation?
Right. So first of all, you must be in prison serving either a death sentence or a life imprisonment after commutation from death. Following Chief Justice's Martha Comer's guidelines in 2021, you also must be serving that sentence as a result of the offense of murder, not robbery with violence. Also, you must have exhausted all your appeals, or you don't want to go the appeal way, because resentencing is not for you to go and say, I am not guilty. You're just contesting the sentence that you've been given, which is the death penalty. You're saying that it's unconstitutional, so that is what you need to do. And then you can draft a submission that you will provide in your petition for the judge to consider. Now, if you can be able to afford, you can have a lawyer. You need to have a lawyer. In fact, it is Reprieve's standing that you should be represented by a lawyer because, you know, of the intricacies around capital litigation. But then again, we are also alive to the fact that most of the people who are in prison for this particular offences cannot be able to afford lawyers. Mm-hmm. And this is where Reprieve comes in, because Reprieve is a charity or is an NGO that is based in the UK and has been working towards eliminating the death penalty globally, and has worked in other jurisdictions to support causes similar to this one, from advocacy on abolition to resentencing, with one of the most successful projects being in Malawi. And that is why we also have the Kenya Resentencing Project following the 2017 Muratetu ruling. So Reprieve has been working to support some of the most deserving inmates, because I mean, we cannot support everyone. Kenya has more than 5,000 inmates sitting in prison for this particular offense who are eligible for resentencing, so we can't be able to do this. But for the most deserving, we are able to provide them with advocates who can represent them in court. You will ask me, how do you determine who is
that was deserving? Actually my next question. Yes. How do you leave me
And you say
no, Martin might go through.
We look at the vulnerability of the offender. Like, for example, old age. You are 70, 80, 90 years old and sitting in prison. You definitely meet the criteria for us to support you. We look at some of the mitigating factors that could have led to this. For instance, mental health is one of the things that we look at. One will tell you that for capital offenses, there's a mental health assessment that is done. But we have, you know, established that the breadth and extent of this mental health assessment do not consider some other mental health illnesses that may not present themselves as, you know, readily as, you know, total insanity, you know, that most of the time does present itself. And of course, with the advent of, you know, conversations around mental health, you will understand what I'm talking about. There are things such as being a victim of gender-based violence that has never been considered until a recent ruling by, is it Justice Nambuye, which sentenced one of the a lady to a day in court. And she actually said, for as long as this court is sitting, I'm sentencing you to serve time. you get, because this person had been constantly subjected to gender-based violence, and they ended up killing their husband in the process. Now, if we did not have the issue of discretion of a judge, Justice Nambuye's hands would have been tied, as Shirley was explaining earlier, and she would have sentenced this woman to the death penalty. But then she considered so many other things and how this can affect you to the extent that you may end up involuntarily committing a crime. Now, I'm not saying that those who are in abusive relationships or are facing gender-based violence should go and kill whoever is subjecting them to this because the court will be lenient. No. Mm-hmm. There are so many other things that must be considered before we get to this level. And another thing that we consider also is the age of the offender. Like I said, if you're old, but also if you're young at the time of committing the offense is also one of the things that we consider. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things that we consider. And I must also say that resentencing is not a simple process. I know, as we are talking like this, maybe there's someone who's seated somewhere and thinking, that's an easy way out. It's not an easy way out. It's a process, and there are very serious legal considerations that have to be made before you get to the final decision that a judge has to make. Mm-hmm. But also to say, if you know all the factors that you have and are presenting match, that definitely, and you're presenting yourself before a judge who is willing to listen to you, you will definitely get a favorable ruling. And a favorable ruling is not saying go home.
It
could be you being resentenced to, maybe now you just got sentenced like today, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Or rather, not today, but let's say you got sentenced to death about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge has listened and they are convinced that, okay, fine, you're eligible for resentencing and I need to revise your sentence. He can decide, Laban, I'm going to resentence you to 40 years. So the 40 years is a named sentence. It mm-hmm. means that in 40 years, you can go home. It also means that you are eligible for parole. So if you behave well in prison and you can demonstrate to the prison authorities that you're reformed, they can make recommendations either to the Power of Mercy Committee or the president, or even to court if there ever appears such a chance that, you know, Laban is a reformed inmate,
mm-hmm.
and we think, given a chance, he should rejoin society and he can become a productive member of society. So if it will be after 25 years of you serving, that is something, as opposed to knowing that for the rest of my natural life, I am committed to prison X. I will never leave. And if we do get a president who is inclined to that, we may actually get, I may actually be executed. So you're not certain about your life, where it ends and how it ends in the end. And I think also in the longer scheme of things, named sentences, one way or another, are a motivator for good behavior, because if you know that I have a chance to go home at whatever given time,
mm-hmm.
you're going to behave well because that's what you're chasing, as opposed to knowing for the rest of your life, this is it. You know,
there's something that
Martin,
you...
if you can just chime in before you ask him.
Martin,
Just three, a few quick pointers. The first is there are certain instances whereby people have actually been convicted to death, to suffer the punishment of death, mm-hmm. and they've actually not committed a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And in the recent past, we've seen in such an instance, you've seen some people have been exonerated. So you can imagine what it feels like losing about 10 or 15 years of your life for a crime you didn't commit.
Mm-hmm.
That is not time to recover. And that is that simply explains why the resentencing project is critically important for many of Kenyans who are convicted to suffer this punishment. The other question you had earlier asked us, what would happen to the victims, or what is justice for victims or families?
In this instance?
Yes, in this instance. In most instances, actually, victims are never consulted when because when somebody commits an offense,
mm-hmm.
you know, the law just, the operation of the law starts taking its shape. But but in certain instances, you find that actually victims would not want to see some of these people actually suffer the punishment of death, because many Kenyans actually are law-abiding citizens, are Christians, and you see, when you tell them, X or Y has to suffer death because he's committed this offense, even if you were, even if it so happened that we were actually going to actually send to somebody that can actually perform the actual act of hanging, that does not help the victims or survivors heal. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I raise this point is when you is we have to draw lessons from other jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. Look at what happened in fact on Sunday, Rwanda celebrated 30 years after the 1994 genocide, whereby in 100 days we saw between 800,000 to 1 million Rwandans being killed. Mm-hmm. Now, assuming Rwanda was to apply the death penalty in its strict sense, mm-hmm. we have to ask ourselves, would we have any Rwandan, or how many Rwandis would we have? Maybe we'd have even less than a couple of thousand of Rwandis, because remember, if you were to hold to account those who are responsible for killing all the 800 or 1,000 Rwandis, then you may have had many people being executed. But mm-hmm. the question we have to ask ourselves, or the lesson we have to draw, is what did Rwanda do? Rwanda used other informal mechanisms, mm-hmm. you know, of accessing justice, like the Gacaca courts, and we've seen also that being applied in other areas, like in northern Uganda, where you've seen very many victims of the Lord's Resistance. You know, how do you bring warring communities, who have killed one another, to live harmoniously? Because mm-hmm. remember, when you look, it's not easy. I mean, Rwanda is made up of three communities: the Hutu, the Tutsi, and the Batwa. Now, if Rwanda could actually manage to, you know, come up with other forms of justice, because justice does not mean simply mean for victims that you must suffer death. There are very many options as to how somebody can suffer, how somebody can actually serve for his time.
Yes.
Then the other thing is, when you look at when you look at the subject of the death penalty, over the last couple of years, we've seen more countries actually coming up to abolish the death penalty. The latest entrant, I think, being Ghana, mm-hmm. that actually President Nana Addo signed a bill that actually removes the death penalty from their statute books. So that brings the AU countries to 27 out of 55, and the bulk of them have actually not been able to actually execute the death sentence. So Kenya draws a lot of experience and admiration from its neighbors and from progressive states, so we must pick a leaf and know that the death penalty just does not have room in our society per se, because I mean, if you're not executing somebody anytime soon, why should you have it in our statute books? And remember, and I emphasize, remember, we have a law that the 2017 Prevention of Torture Act that simply says we shall not subject Kenyans to torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. Mm-hmm. So, and yet, when you sentence somebody to actually suffer death,
that's
then you know you're basically reversing all the gains. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the framers of our current constitution, it's a progressive piece of it's a progressive document that many countries have actually drawn experience from. So we can only hope to be as progressive as other countries in as far as the journey to abolishing the death penalty in Kenya is concerned. We must jump on that global movement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There have been a lot of efforts that have been done by civil society organizations like the Kenya Human Rights Commission, both at national and international level, within the regional spaces of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights,
mm-hmm.
and also within the spaces of the Human Rights Council. The other thing is, we are all aware that there has been a perception. There have been some perception studies done by the Power of Mercy Committee, and it is not quite robust because apparently, actually, at that point in time when they wanted more money to actually conduct a comprehensive perception survey, the government actually informed them that they needed more money for elections. There is also another survey study that has been done by the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights, and.
Yeah.
You'd see its findings are positive, that many Kenyans actually want this abolished from our statute books.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, Martin, when you mentioned Kenya is a majority Christian state and they wouldn't want to see someone being convicted to murder, it reminded me of a clip that we've just heard on our news of someone who actually says he is a Christian, and he has this famous mantra that he keeps telling people who are corrupt and everything else, that mambo ni matatu. And one of the things is he actually suggests you might he might book an appointment for you with your maker.
That is a very valid conversation, and Laban, I wish you could. I hope you will invite us in the near future to have a candid conversation around the state of governance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unfortunately, the person I'm talking about is actually the president.
True.
You will who you will expect to assent to the bill that you have said, Honorable Wandayi, is actually working on.
Yes, actually, that is what I'm saying. That is a subject for another day. But in terms of the progressive debate, conversation around this going on in Parliament, we know. I think sometime last year, the Chief Justice actually made a submission before to Parliament on why certain offences should actually not attract the death penalty, and basically broad conversation around reforms in our criminal and justice system. And you'd be shocked, but one of the people who supported the submissions by her ladyship was Honorable Samson Cherargei, and we all know it's an open secret that he's one of the president's blue-eyed boys. So,
yeah.
And in fact, if I quote, he said the right to life is sacrosanct. So you can't just take somebody's life just like that, by the stroke of a judgment or this. But you see, it goes on to show that, but more importantly, even with our political class, they don't have the appetite for
to execute
any Kenyan. And that is why over the past couple of years, we have seen former past presidents commuting those who are sentenced to suffer the punishment of death. They've been commuted. Kibaki, when he was president, commuted a number of people.
Yep.
Same applies to Uhuru. So we can only hope that the same trajectory moves forward.
Actually, but President Ruto, when he came in, one of his first acts was to do the same.
Yes. Later. So, and we do appreciate, because it's progressive, knowing that we are as a country heading in the right direction. But why I said the reason why I said that very many Kenyans are Christian, that is a fact, because let us be honest. And I'm happy to say it on air. Have you ever had Kenyans challenging any pastors or Christians? No, we don't challenge them. What do most religions teach us? You know, most religions teach us, you know, to preserve the right to life. Mm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, most preachings, whether you're Muslim, SDS, Seventh Day, there's no church who teach you, who tell you that, you know, when somebody kills your kin, you know, return the favor with the same. No, they always preach, you know, peace. And you remember, in all Kenya's dark moments, 2007, 2008, religious leaders have played an instrumental role in, you know, in trying to bring us together.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever the things are haywire, you see, you know, religious leaders have actually played a critical role. And I can reemphasize that Kenyans actually, you know, in fact, Kenya is a God-fearing nation.
Mm-hmm.
That is why when you look at bits of our constitution and even bits of our national anthem, you know, there's that allusion to that. So, but the long and short of it is, Laban, it is about time that Kenya completely abolished the death penalty. It is about time that we joined the global movement of abolitionists and just did away with the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
It's about time that we, you know, had many people commuted, you know, we need, you know, a Kenya that is free of the offense of the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you put it into context, when you put the criteria, the procedure on how to go about it, who to approach, how it will be done, how you pick up the cases and stuff like that, maybe there are people who you might soften their hearts.
Mm.
But I'll still go back, even as we wind the conversation down, it's still on the victim. You said, for instance, during sentencing, case in point, the one that we saw recently, we saw the judge saying, I received a report from the victims and they said this. I'm just wondering, as the resentencing project, when you pick up a case, for instance, and you decide, okay, we are going with this, do you also just reach out to the family of the victim or to the victim to just ask them, after X number of years, do you still feel the same, or would you like this person to, what would you like this person to be released, or what type of sentence would you like to be considered for this person after X number of years?
Thanks for that question, Laban. I think engaging with victims or survivors of the crime of, you know, who's maybe keen have suffered, have been victims of death is critical, because part of healing as a nation is, you know, to actually engage those who are affected by a specific offense. And of course, when you're informed that your next of kin or your loved one has been killed, most of us, just like any human being, you may be so angry and you know, why him or why her, but remember that has happened, and you know, there can be a number of circumstances, and like Charlie earlier, you know, articulated, you know, the ingredients you clearly look at when you're charging somebody for the offense of murder, but then as you go on as a victim or a survivor, you realize that you can't hold a grudge forever, because it's not going to. In fact, it wears you down when you know. You it's like every time you think of somebody, you know you get hurt, you get annoyed. And when you look at, I'm fortunate that over the years I've worked with victims of survivors of sexual and gender based violence, or even victims of the post election violence of 2008 or 2008. And I've also worked, my work at the Kenya Human Rights Commission has also seen me work with survivors of colonial repression, people who are subjected to severe forms of torture. And you see that over the, when you engage them, they actually want to have a meaningful conversation around how do you heal from those violations that we are subjected to.
And I guess what I'm trying to bring across, even when you look at the example you gave of Rwanda, with the Gashasha courts, or even the Republic of South Africa with the Truth and Justice Reconciliation Commission, one of the things that came out is that platform that they were accorded to be able at least to sit in some way means of form, and see the accuser and try to understand what exactly this is what it means. It meant to me. This is what you did to me. Do you feel remorseful or something of that nature? What I'm trying to ask is for the victim, how do you give them closure? Because if you are a victim and then you just had an NGO helped someone to get to get from death sentence to 4 years in jail, you kind of feel you've been betrayed by the system.
So what most what we do with most victims is that we have been able to offer psychosocial and counseling to very many victims, because sometimes when you're informed that your loved one has passed on. Or even if I give a case scenario, look at 2007-2008, whereby we had 1,200 Kenyans lose their lives, right? So, you know, some people were traumatized, and sometimes when you look at our criminal justice system, other than the justice bit, you don't look at the needs of the victim. So other than the fact that, yes, victims need justice, some victims are not given psychosocial treatment or even counseling, so... And that is a huge gap when you look at our criminal justice system. We're more of, you know, on the legal bit, whereby, you know, so if you've committed an offense, then how do the wheels of justice come into motion? And even when you look at the progressive reforms, including budgetary allocations by the government, you know, there's not much that is given to psychosocial treatment. So as civil society organizations like ourselves, we do invest a lot in trying to counsel victims. We speak to those who are convicted for a number of years on an annual basis, and from time to time, KHRs, including other civil society actors, do conduct legal aid clinics in prisons, and we specifically try to target those who are convicted to suffer, you know, the punishment of death. Because when you look at death convicts, they're confined. You're not even allowed to, you know, engage, or you know, at times you're not allowed to engage and freely interact with other prisoners. So you can imagine being in solitary confinement for a very inordinate period of time. Yes.
And also just to
as
add,
you sum it up, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Just to add that, first of all, there are also legislations that do protect victims of offences. There's the Victims of Offences Act, or I think in other, you know, terms, sometimes it's called the Victim Protection Act.
Mm-hmm.
And this does provide certain measures that a victim can take, including even making what we call the victim impact assessment, or, you know, reports, which are done by the probation department, as Shadley said. And I will emphasize again that, number one, resentencing is not a very is not a simple process, right? It's long, and it has certain you know, procedures that have to be followed. And one of them has to be that the probation department must get in touch with the family of the victim, mm-hmm. so that they can do an assessment to see where this family is. Number two, we always encourage the person who is seeking resentencing to try and reconcile with the family of the victim that was affected. Like I said, sometimes, and again, remember, resentencing is not about, I've been sentenced in 2020 and I want to be, I mean, I was sentenced to death 2020 and I want to be resentenced in 2021. There's always time that is allowed to pass, so that some of the things that we're talking about, you know, for people to even get used to the idea that you've been punished enough,
mm-hmm.
to, you know, sort of like settle. And this allows for people, sometimes you find that even the offender, he or she has tried to reach out to the family of the affected, and by their own means, they have tried to reconcile one way or another. Now, it's not to say that there are some who are adamant. Yes, there are. And if they don't feel like this person should be resentenced, that report is usually made to the court so that, again, the judge can consider their mm-hmm. sentiments and make a ruling. It is why I, for example, will seek to be resentenced, and after the family of the victim will bring a report to say, no, we don't want Winnie, the judge will say, okay, because, you know, I should just resentence you because at the end of the day, you're entitled to it. It's the constitutional right. It's your constitutional right. I should do this. They may decide, if the victim's family had said, we are fine with you, I'd have given you 10 years. But now they're not okay with that. So I'll give you 40 to allow time to pass, mm-hmm. so that within this time, maybe this family will be persuaded to, you know, feel like Winnie has reformed and now they can rejoin society. And also, before rejoining society, we just don't get released from committee and boom, you're back home in Kadonzweni enjoying githeri.
Mm-hmm.
There is a process again, mm-hmm. which is people have, again, through the probation department, do what we call reintegration visits. They, you have to speak to chiefs, you have to speak to members of the community, even to see, once released, where are you going? Because we could be releasing you to a community that is waiting for you to lynch you. Is that what we want? Not really. So we want you to go home to a place where you feel embraced. And if back in Kadonzeni nobody wants Laban, then maybe there are other ways through which we can see where are you needed or where can you go so that you can restart your life somewhere else. But like I said, it's a long process that also does include the families of the victims. It doesn't leave them out. It also involves your own family, because it's one thing to assume that you're wanted back home by your family. It may not be the case. So it's a long process. And with regard to abolition, I want to say yes. I mean, like Martin said, this is a conversation that has gone on for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
I started working on abolition work from way back in 2010. Now, this is how many years later, almost? You know, over 15. A teenager working yeah. on this, and I found others who'd started the conversations way before, and we are still there having the same conversation. Bills have been drafted, sent to parliament, come back to us. We've gotten to points where we felt, oh yeah, we have it, tumeshinda, kameenda. Then we come back to the same conversation. But you see, what is happening is that we have what we call progressive, you know, judgments, or there are positive strides that are leading us towards that journey on abolition. Reprieve is working with civil society organizations as well as the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights to activate advocacy towards abolishing the death penalty. There are so many things we want to do, but the first step is obviously creating an awareness, and we want to thank Capital for giving us an opportunity to, you know, have this conversation, because we are opening up, you know, people's understanding of what the death penalty is. I can tell you, last year, so many people did not even know that there was a death penalty, but now they do know. And we just want to continue having this conversation so that we have that understanding, what it means, the implications of sentencing people to death, and what alternatives exist before we go to, you know, totally asking that, you know, the public supports us in abolishing the death penalty.
Thank you very much, Winnie, Shirley, and Martin. Thank you for making time. Thank you for actually taking us through the whole process. And for everyone who's listening in, thank you very much. I hope you've gotten informed, and I hope in some way they have either gotten your support or have made you realize that there is a conversation that needs to be heard. But from us, from the Global Digest, it is good night, and thanks for listening.